Working towards 3D models, so I'm going to talk about a lot of that today. Okay, so there's two kind of topics that we've recently worked on that I wanted to highlight. One is the dependence on spatial dimension of the neutrino mechanism. So what are the differences between 1D spherically symmetric simulations, 2D axis symmetric simulations, and 3D fully Cartesian simulations? And does spatial dimension itself, independent of anything with neutrinos, transport, hydrodynamics, does the effect of spatial dimension at all change kind of qualitatively or quantitatively what happens in our core collapse simulations? The other topic I wanted to talk about, which actually I'll talk about first, was the origin of neutron star kicks. So recently we've done what I think are very interesting, nice simulations where we follow collapse, we have asymmetric explosions, and we see the neutron star form and then be kicked off axis. So I want to kind of highlight that. I will mention our team. Adam, of course, at Princeton, graduate student Tim Brandt, who worked with me on the neutron star kick paper, Anne Almgren at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, and then Christian at Caltech. So just to give you an idea, here is a visualization of one of our 3D supernova simulations. Down in here, you'll see the neutron star. The shock surface is out here in blue. And inside here, we have all sorts of instabilities, neutrino-driven convection, turbulence, shock instabilities, the whole shebang. And now you'll recognize this figure. This figure I like a lot. Bronson showed it, and it's from the Oak Ridge group. But kind of highlights what happens in core collapse. Massive star starts to collapse. The central density of the region starts to increase until it gets up to nuclear densities. The equation state stiffens. You form your proto-neutron star, and a bounce shock is launched. That shock then starts to propagate outward. It stalls due to nuclear dissociation and neutrino losses. And the whole idea then is that once you form this sea of neutrinos that's built up, they start to diffuse out of the neutrino spheres. They interact then in the special gain region here, which they can capture on free nucleons. And then if you can tap enough of that energy, the neutrinos themselves may be able to re-energize the shock, push it out through the star, and lead to a successful core collapse supernova. So the idea, at least computationally, is to study this with large-scale simulations in multi-dimensions and try to understand the physics that's happening and what's leading to either failed explosions or successful explosions. So with that in mind, here's another laundry list similar to Bronson's. You have to incorporate gravity, neutrinos, turbulence, convection, shock instabilities, potentially rotation, magnetic fields, nucleosynthesis, and GR effects if you want to do everything. Now, in practice, we can't do everything. If you tried to incorporate all this stuff, you would just be swamped, so you have to pick and choose your battles. And so what we focus on is gravity, neutrinos, turbulence right now. We do simulations of non-rotating progenitors, although we started to do some of rotating progenitors. And again, the goal is to produce 3D models with sufficient realism that that hopefully lead to supernova explosions, because that's what happens in nature. Okay, so just to give you kind of a very, very brief history of the field, Stirling Colgate in 61 pioneered the direct hydrodynamic collapse mechanism, which by, it's exactly what it sounds like, the star collapses in, you form the neutron star, there's a bounce shock. Now if you just look at it hydrodynamically, that shock has enough energy to blow the star apart, and that's what they thought happened. But if you include neutrinos, then you start to develop neutrino losses, and that just undermines your shock. So it leads to this delay, this stalling of the shock, which then hopefully is re-energized by neutrinos. So if you kind of wrap everything back the last 15 years of progress or so, people started doing 1D spherically symmetric simulations and found that for the majority of progenitors, we couldn't get them to explode. In the early to mid-90s, people started to be able to do 2D axisymmetric simulations and got marginal explosions in a few cases, but still the vast majority of progenitors were not exploding. And now, in the last probably year to 2 years, we've entered the realm of 3D, fully 3D simulations. And it's going to be very interesting in the next few years what the different groups find and if we see explosions in 3D. Okay, so before I get to the kind of dimensional dependence I wanted to talk about what I think is a very cool thing we worked on recently, which is recoil from core collapse. So trying to understand the origin of pulsar kicks and neutron star kicks. So we used our old code, Vulcan, which is a 2D code. In Vulcan, it's a 2D radiation hydro code. We cannot produce explosions with it, except maybe by the acoustic mechanism, which is debatable whether that actually works or not. So what we had to do is we had to actually induce an explosion. So we used a 15 solar mass progenitor. We used the Shen equation of state, and we supplemented the electron and anti-electron neutrino luminosities so that we could induce an explosion. So what you'll see here is you'll see that there's an explosion which is primarily up in this direction. You form the neutron star here at the center of the grid, and then it gets pushed down here as the explosion takes place. Now, part of the motivation for doing this study was that there is some really nice work by Thomas Yonka's group, principally two papers by Scheck, and then more recently they've tried to do this in 3D, where they can follow the evolution on very large scales. They can see the neutron star kind of accelerate, but they have to cut the core out, so they don't actually form the neutron star. So what we wanted to do was we wanted to do the entire process. We're going to do the collapse, form the neutron star, watch the explosion, and then see itself consistently get pushed off axis. So what you're going to see here is a movie of this process happening. On the left side, you're going to see the colors are electron fraction, and you're going to see the inner 50 kilometers. So the neutron star will form here. The white line here is the center of the grid. And over here, you'll watch the entire explosion. You'll see it kind of develop here, push out, and then come up here, and you should see the neutron star recoil downward. So here it goes. Here comes the shock out, starting to explode now. Pushing up, you can start to see the asymmetry develop. The neutron star is formed, and down it goes. So we follow the evolution as far as we can, which is until the shock reaches basically the edge of the grid, then we lose momentum conservation. So this was computationally difficult, getting momentum conservation to work in this, but we do have this one two-dimensional run with Vulcan. And you can ask, what's driving the neutron star kick? Well, first of all, one thing to point out is this computation gets to about 150 kilometers per second. I've been redoing these calculations with our new code, Castor, which we'll talk about in a minute, and I have about 15 runs. And there I get anywhere from 50 kilometers per second for a kick up to 650. So in 2D and 3D, I think we're going to see this achieve higher velocities for the neutron star. But we only have one 2D run with Vulcan. And what we see is that at late times, you can ask the question, what are the terms that lead to the acceleration of the neutron star? Well, one is gravity, one's asymmetric momentum, and there's an isotropic pressure term, but there's also asymmetries in the neutrino field. And all of those can lead to acceleration of the neutron star. What you can see here, first thing I want to point out is the radiation field, the neutrinos, are actually pretty isotropic. I mean, there are asymmetries in the neutrino field, but they're not that substantial. When you calculate out the effect of the neutrinos on the kick itself, what you see is they contribute a couple kilometers per second to the overall kick. So the first thing to take away from this is the neutrinos aren't really doing anything substantial here with the kick. What actually is doing it is the hydrodynamics, the matter itself. And so at late times, what you have is you have an asymmetric distribution of matter. And is there chalk? Yes, there's chalk here. So what you're seeing is kind of a dominating by a gravitational tugboat effect. So if you blow up like this, you eject matter up here with very high velocities, and you eject matter down here with slightly less. Now, because you're blowing up asymmetrically anyway, there's a rocket effect which pushes the neutron star down like this, but now you're closer to slower-moving matter, so there's more mass down here. So that exerts a gravitational pull that then accelerates you further in the direction of the kick. So for this calculation, that's what we're seeing here. This late time here is dominated by the gravity of the material down at the bottom, and that's what's supplying the acceleration. At the end of our calculation, we still have substantial acceleration, 350 kilometers per second squared. So if this goes for another few seconds, you could get up to 1,000 kilometer per second kick. Okay. Now I want to talk about 3D core collapse, because as we've heard so far from Teus, Bronson, Kay, that 3D core collapse can be very, very different from 1D and 2D, and I hope to actually convince you that that's the case today. So to look at 3D, we had to develop a new code. So for the last 3 years, we've been working really, really hard to develop Castro. Castro stands for Compressible Astro. It's an adaptive mesh refinement code. It's radiation hydro. We can run it in one spherically symmetric dimension, 2D axisymmetric dimensions, and then fully 3D Cartesian. For the radiation, we use multi-group flux limit diffusion. Gravity, we do multi-grid Poisson solves. And this code scales extremely well. We scale to over 200,000 cores, weak scaling, of course. Typically, for 3D, we run anywhere in the 64,000 to about 100,000 core range. Fortunately, we don't have access to Jaguar, so I can't get 220,000 cores. But So again, our team is Adam, myself, Ann Almgren, John Belligan at Lawrence Berkeley, and Lewis Howell. And just to kind of give you an idea why AMR is very useful, in the core clefts context, you're really interested in resolving what's going on in the shock, which is way down in the center. So if you have a very big grid, you don't need to put resolution everywhere. You just want to put it where the action is. And that's typically down here in the center. So that's why AMR would be very useful for our context. And this allows us to do very fast runs, I think, compared to fixed grid approaches. Here's some pretty eye candy of some test stuff we did a few years ago. So you can see kind of the structures we get here. In case shock here, there's a lot of turbulence going on. This one is electron fraction. This is entropy. The one nice thing about doing 3D is you don't really see the effect of a grid here at all in any of these things. So when you explode, it tends to be in more or less random directions. Okay, here's a movie. This is going to show entropy contour, and you'll see the entropy will zoom out, and then it will fade, and you'll see the neutrons start down at the center. So here it comes. Now the camera is rotating. So what looks like rotation in the eye is not actually rotation. This think of just as expanding outward, and we're rotating now with the camera. We're zooming out. You can see these big, big structures kind of developing, these large convective eddies, if you want to call them. We're fading away now, and down here you can see the neutron star, or the innermost, it's not quite the neutron star, I think that's the 10 to the 10 gram per cc surface. Now, yes? No, we're doing hydro all the way down.
We're doing hydro all the way down.
So we're forming the neutron star here, and that's just the visualization of it.
That's just a contour,
that's right, yep. Now, one thing I should mention is that right now we have just started, as of a few days ago, our first fully 3D radiation hydro run of this, where we're doing multi-group flux limit diffusion. These problems here where we're getting an explosion, I'm doing what's more simplistic radiation transport. So I'm putting neutrino heating and cooling and electron capture, but I'm not doing full-blown multi-group flux limit diffusion. I have done that in 1D and 2D with Castor, and I'll mention a little bit about that in a minute. And we just started a few days ago our first fully 3D in both the hydro and the radiation sector calculation of core clefts. Okay, so I wanted to talk about spatial dimension. This is from a paper we published recently, which we think is a big, big key to the neutrino mechanism. And, let me just go into it. So the very first thing we wanted to do is with this more simplistic transport approach, which is neutrino heating and cooling, I wanted to look at just the dependence of spatial dimension on the simulations. So what we did is, because Castro does 1D, 2D, 3D, we fixed every single thing in the run. We fixed the equation of state, the resolution, the progenitor, the radiation transport scheme we use. Everything was fixed. The only thing that changed was the spatial dimension of the simulation. And what we found was very interesting. If you look here at a 1D simulation, and it's just been rotated, what you see is at the same point in time where the 1D simulation is not exploding, we see explosions in the 2D corresponding simulation. You can do the same thing between 2D and 3D, and at 2D, when we see an explosion here, I mean, we see a lack of explosion here in the 2D, we see an explosion in the 3D at the same time. So spatial dependence is playing a very large role. You can see this even better when you look at the average shock radii as a function of time. So the 1D models are in black, 2D in blue, and 3D in red, and the numbers correspond to the model run. So if you look at a two-dimensional 1.9 model here, it blows up after probably about 1.1 seconds. But if you look at the corresponding 3D run, it blows up over here at about 0.3 seconds. So that's about 0.88 second difference between the two. That's a huge effect. We can look at that even more so, where we plot the critical driving luminosity, those are the numbers in the last plot, as a function of the accretion rate at the time of explosion. And what you can see is they follow these trajectories. The 1D lies up here, the 2D down here, and the 3D here. So to explode in 1D, you have to be above this curve. And to explode in 2D, you have to be above this curve. And to explode in 3D, you have to be above this curve. So if you're lying somewhere in parameter space here, you would expect to see an explosion in 2D, but not in 1D. So what we think is happening is perhaps nature lives down in here somewhere, in which case you would expect to see explosions in 2D, but not in 3D. So, I mean, sorry, in 3D, but not in 2D. So since we're just entering the age where we are actually doing 3D simulations, it'll be very interesting, again, over the next couple of years to see what the different groups have, because if all the 3D models start to explode, it may be that this is a critical effect. The one thing I'd like to point out is if you look at the difference between 1D and 3D, it's 50% easier to explode in 3D than it is in 1D. That's a factor of 2. That's not a 5% effect. That's not a 10% effect. That's a factor of 2. So that could be a lot. This could be a much bigger effect than some of the other things that people are looking at. Now, you could ask, why do you get explosions as you go up in dimension? Well, one thing is we see higher entropies as you go up in explosions. So here for 1D, we get an entropy here. 2D is higher, and then 3D is significantly higher, too. So we think what's happening is that you're dwelling, the matter that's coming into the shocked region is dwelling longer as you go up in dimension. That's allowing it to capture more neutrinos, to heat up to higher entropies, and then to induce an explosion. This is the average entropy in the gain region. So if you think of kind of the flow of matter through the shocked region as a diffusive process, this makes a little bit of sense, because in 1D, you can just go radially inward and outward. In 2D, you can go radially, but you can go azimuthally, too. And in 3D, you can go all three directions. So what you would expect is that potentially this stuff is dwelling in the higher dimensions longer. So here's an example of this in 2D. You can see the paths of the particles as they flow through the region and have to take these winding turns, where in 1D, they would plunge directly in on a straight line. So we've looked at this in 2D versus 3D also. And what we can do is we can calculate out the dwell time for particles in 2D versus 3D. The 2D particles are the color map here, and the 3D are this guy up here. And what we're seeing is that, on average, they're getting to higher entropies in 3D, but they're also getting to much longer dwell times. So there seems to be a spreading out. You're getting to higher entropies, and you're dwelling for much, much longer. The longest particles in the 3D simulation are going out to almost 0.2 seconds. And their corresponding counterparts in 2D only go out to about maybe 1.3 or so. Here's an example of kind of what one of our explosions looks like. Again, when we're dialing it up, you can see these large structures coming out here. It looks very different from what it does in 2D. We see some fragmentation breaking up in this one. Now, so I did want to say something about the SASE. The SASE is the L equals 1, M equals 0 mode, or the other modes if you're in 3D, the M equals negative 1 and M equals 1 mode. The SASE is in all of our simulations. In 2D, we see very strong effects. So this is with Castro, a 2D simulation. We see dominance. A lot of power is in the L equals 1 mode. You can see this kind of up and down approach here. It's going like this. So we see a clear SASE in 2D. This one will explode in a second. I mean, in a few moments, maybe a second also. It's getting close. You can see the entropy is getting higher here, the red. Here it goes, and the explosion starts. Off it goes. So that one ran for about 1.4 seconds. So the SASE has been suggested as a lot of things. It's definitely present. One thing it was suggested earlier was a way to spin up pulsars to very high values. We looked at this recently and published a paper in 3D, and we didn't see significant spin up. We got about a factor of 10 less than the earlier work suggested. What we do see in 3D is we don't really see a strong SASE. Again, it's there, the modes are there, but the power looks to be spread out more over a bunch of modes. You can see here again, you don't see any a very strong sloshing back and forth. Here again, we got the neutron star down here. This is an entropy surface. You get kind of these are a cold entropy plume here coming down, kind of a sheet more or less, not even a plume. As for a non-rotating model, we've also started to look at rotating initial models. Here's an example of one. This guy comes out, you'll see. This is a slowly initially rotating model. These are preliminary results. We haven't published anything with these yet. We get a lot more fragmentation and some breakup here. If you compare just slices through of the non-rotating and the rotating model, you see for the non-rotating model, we have this more or less kind of donut structure. You get some breakup here. But for this the slowly rotating model, we do get a lot more kind of mixing going on in some regions here. And there's an axis here. This is the rotation axis. Explodes a little bit earlier than the non-rotating version too, which you would expect. Here's one more movie of one of our explosions. Again, you can see these bubbling, these large-scale overturns. Okay, and just to wrap up, we do see a very strong dimensional dependence in our core collapse simulations. It's a factor of 2, again, easier to explode in 3D than it is in 1D. It will be very, very interesting to see all of the results coming out in 3D from all the different groups in the next few years. If we all start to see explosions, it may be that this dimensional dependence was one of the main reasons. Also, recoil is a natural outcome of the hydrodynamics and asymmetric explosions, and we're currently working on that in 3D, which I think will be very interested. And then again, I just wanted to advertise, we've started our first fully 3D radiation hydro production run simulation of a 15 solar mass progenitor. Unfortunately, we'll probably have to wait a little while. We're looking at months here for this to work, but it'll be very interesting to see what that does and to compare to some of the previous work from others. So thank you.
Oh, so just one slide back, you're rotating and non-rotating, yes?
Yep.
So, do you have an explanation for that? Is it shear?
This is very preliminary as of like a few weeks ago. So I think it is. I think there's a little bit more shear kind of going on as you rotate around.
If there wasn't a lot of shear, I would expect actually exactly the opposite.
Yeah, and it may be, you know, this is a slow, this was not a lot of rotation at all in this model. So if you put in a lot more, you actually might see that the shear be stabilized more or less, and you might not expect more mixing. So I think that, I'm not sure. If you look at the entire range of parameters, maybe you get a little bit more shear for slowly rotating things, and you stabilize when you spin up a lot faster, and you don't get as much. But
right. Well, maybe Rodrigo have a question about your conclusion about the SASE and 3D.
Sure. Yeah.
So what you said was you didn't really see a significant SASE because
right.
it's sort of polluted with all this other stuff that's going
right.
on.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And I don't. Think that
it's
most
there.
I think most of the practitioners would probably agree with that statement, right?
Right.
That it's you know it's polluted and sort of swamped in 3D with all the other stuff that's
right.
going on. Just as a comment.
About 50% of the neutrino luminosity does not come out of the neutron star, but comes from the accretion stream and the compressed accreting matter. Now, if you compare the 2D and 3D situations in your model, do you take a fixed luminosity or do you take into account that this accretion stream and pattern will significantly give feedback to the neutrino luminosity?
No, there's no feedback on the core. So these are for fixed luminosity. So we use the luminosity as just a fixed input over time and we dial it up and down. But we do it the same way as a function of dimension. So in theory, if the if you put in your full-blown radiation hydro and everything's the same, you would still have that same evolution. Even though there's an evolution in luminosity, you would have it the same in all dimensions. So I think that the main thing, the point is, even though we put in a fixed luminosity and drove explosions like that, we kept everything the same. But it was a fixed luminosity, that's right. Yep.
Yeah, that's interesting to know because It's very interesting to see this huge difference, but there could actually be negative feedback in a
right.
more evolved model that
That's right.
takes
That's right,
away
yeah.
some of it.
And what we would eventually like to do, and what I would encourage other groups to do, is to repeat the same things with the radiation hydro codes. So we're just getting there now with our 3D version, but to actually look at it 1D, 2D, 3D with the full-blown transport in, fixing everything else the same, and see if you see similar effects to that.
So that's certainly a name we have. So
okay, good.
It's good to hear
good.
You say that. So could you look at your dwell time plot just briefly to make sure I understand exactly what's being shown? Yeah, there. So are those only matter parcels that are in the gain region?
That's right. These are only, yep. So we track when they go into the gain region. Yes. We track how long they stay in there. And then we calculate average properties for them.
Right. And the contours for the 3D are roughly what the color map
They're
is?
They're roughly
the
color map here, yeah. Yeah.
So I guess, I don't know, there's not much to calibrate my intuition, but I'm actually surprised that the increase in entropy for the 3D, given the longer dwell times that are almost 50% longer, that in fact that isn't more skewed. you know, because it's a cumulative effect, right? If you're in the gain region, you haven't slipped below the gain radius. If you've been exposed for 50% longer to the flux, I would have actually expected the 3D distribution
to
go up and to the right more.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's just as a comment, that's sort of interesting that.
I think one thing to keep in mind too is a little bit. I mean, the average. If you look at the averages are up by maybe a factor of like one unit here or something. So it's not, on average there are particles that are getting to much higher, but they're kind of in the tails of the distribution. So
what I was going to suggest is on the other plot. You know, even if there was some way to communicate, how much of the cumulative heating happens at very near the gain radius.
Oh, these are density contours. So these are showing how many particles. So most of the stuff is down, you know, down in this region here.
Yeah, okay.
And then the tails have they have particles in there, but it's not that the bulk of the matter is up in here. It's down in this region here.
Right. So it really is. So that would help clarify whether or not it was really due completely to dimensionality. That is the fact that in the gain region you have a lot of degrees of freedom to move and increase your heating time, rather than just something to do with just the flow.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
So recently there's been proposed some other criteria for successful supernova relating the local sound speed to, say, the escape speed. Have you looked at comparing any of these other ideas for what could be caused?
Yeah, so this is work that Todd Thompson and his graduate student, Andre, that worked on. I don't want to say too much about it. We have looked at it, and there's a couple of things that were on that paper. There's the sound speed criteria. But then there's also that there's more cooling in the 2D simulations than there would be in a 3D simulation. I have looked at that, and that does seem to be true for our stuff. The 2D seems to cool a little bit more efficiently than the 3D does. What I have looked at from their conditions so far seem to hold up for our simulations. But I don't want to say too much about it. We're looking at that.
I have a question on the parallelism of the code. So I see both your code and previous scale up to 200,000 processors and so on.
Right.
And these two codes where communication cost is fairly important in the IDRO. So what makes those codes so good at scaling?
A lot of work.
Is there a lack of communication between the...
There is, and then to scale to 200, we have to do this kind of hybrid open MPI kind of threading approach to it. So it is a lot of massaging for these things. And, you know, again, the scaling to over 200,000 cores is a weak scaling approach with only a few levels of refinement. So in principle, it's hard for us to run all the way up there right now. You know, we can do in the 64 to 100,000 range with our full-blown thing, and it's, you know, it's not perfect. It's a little bit reduced. It's probably comparable to what you guys are seeing.
Yeah,
but
I think the point is when we say it scales to that, it's weak scaling.
Weak scaling, yeah, yeah. That's
and,
right.
And we actually, we benefit or cursed by the theme of this conference itself, that at each spatial grid point, we have lots of physics to do.
Right.
And so that, you know, doing a transpose to do a dimensional sweep for the hydrodynamics, it's relatively cheap compared to all the flops I have to do to actually compute the transport.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
So you mentioned in the last slide the 3D neutrino, 3D radiation hydrodynamics. Mm-hmm. So what kind of numerical method are you using for radiation part? In 3D,
we're doing multi-flux, multi-group flux limit diffusion. We use three energy groups. We put the electrons, anti-electrons in each bin, and then we use mu taus, anti-mu's, anti-taus in another one. And it's very expensive. So, but it's fully 3D, whereas you know some of the other groups do ray by ray. It's cheaper for them. This though, there's a trade-off because we have AMR here. We don't have to do as much resolution other places, so we do win a little bit on the AMR, which allows us to actually go to the 3D radiation. So we're crossing our fingers, and again, we just started something, and I don't know, there's always problems along the way when you do this. So, but we have done it in 2D and 1D, And in those cases, it again is fully 2D radiation hydro, 1D. And we basically verified results for old codes like Vulcan. So we don't see explosions in 2D with Castro or 1D. So, and we're just starting this, and I don't know what it will do.
Any question left for Jason? If not, let's thank both speakers again.